Studies at Marine Corps University presents America and Iran, Endless Enemies. Presented by Ambassador John W. Limbert of the United States Naval Academy. This is the fifth lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Framing the Iranian Challenge. Ambassador John Limbert holds the Class of 1955 Chair of Middle Eastern Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy. During a 33-year career in the United States Foreign Service, he served mostly in the Middle East and Islamic Africa. He was president of the American Foreign Service Association and ambassador to Mauritania. In 2009-2010, while on leave from the Naval Academy, he served as deputy assistant secretary in the department's Bureau of Near East Affairs. Before joining the Foreign Services, he taught in Iran as a Peace Corps volunteer in Kurdistan and at Shiraz University. He has written numerous articles and books on Middle Eastern subjects, including Iran at War with History, Shiraz in the Age of Taifa, and Negotiating with Iran. Ambassador Limbert holds the Department of State's highest award, Distinguished Service Award, and the Award for Valor, which he received in 1981 after 14 months as a hostage in Iran. Ambassador Limbert holds his PhD from Harvard University in History and Middle Eastern Studies. This lecture took place Monday, 28 February 2011, 1300-1430 Gray Research Center, Marine Corps Base, Quantico, Virginia.
Thank you for braving the weather coming here. I think after listening to Ambassador John Limbert, you'll agree that it was worth every drop of rain on your head. this is as an American, there are a few people that I look at and I say, you know what, I'm so glad that I belong and hold the same citizenship as that person. Most of the people are like Thomas Jefferson and people who are not here. There's a man who every time I listen to, I honestly feel like that. I feel, you know what, I belong to the same country he did, because it's not just what Ambassador Limbert represents as a diplomat, as a scholar, but also what I believe as an American, as a compassionate person, as somebody who knows Iran more than not only any other diplomat I know, but any other person here. He and I, when we always speak, we speak in Persian, because his Persian is my native tongue, is better. He actually gave a talk in Persian when we were in Tampa on something other than what we all look at, security. He was talking about architecture in Shiraz, in southern Iran, during the time of Hafiz, who is a poet. Those of you who have looked at Iran, Hafiz is a very important person. He is a full scholar of the region. Ambassador Limbert also downplays that he was a U.S. diplomat in 1979 when the United States Embassy was taken over. He is one of the hostages who was there, for which he has received the highest honor that the State Department can bestow on anybody, which is the Distinguished Service Award for Valor. Currently, Ambassador Limbert holds the Class of 1955 Chair for Middle East Studies at the U.S. Naval Academy. He was asking whether or not any of the students are here. So if you're from TBS, you may have been in his classes there, but I don't know if you are or not. If you are, welcome. And he has a very distinguished Foreign Service. He did not stop with being a hostage. That didn't put him down. He actually went to reach the rank of ambassador. He was ambassador of the United States, ambassador to Marine III. Ambassador Limbert's last job with the State Department was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, where he was also, I think he was mainly working on how to negotiate or deal with the Iranians. And that service ended in last year in about November or October. So he comes fresh from that. For me, as I said, it's an honor to not only be a citizen of the same country, but to call him a friend. It's always a pleasure to see him. And I also welcome all of you. Jerry, sir, thank you for coming. And I just want to recognize my current boss, my former boss, Mr. Half Dine is here, and I'm very glad that you made it from Washington here. Before coming here, I was part of the establishment that Mr. Dine held. So all of you, thank you. Please.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tarzi, and thank you, Adam, and thank you to all the good people here at Marine Corps University. It's as one says, it's always nice to be out of Washington, although it isn't that far. Listening to that very kind introduction, I was reminded of something I read about very recently, where a researcher at the University of California, I think a sociologist, did research about flattery. And the subject was, the problem was, at what point does flattery cease to be effective? And the result was maybe as you might expect, there is no such point. Now, our Afghan and Iranian friends, of course, have known that for thousands of years already. All she had to do was ask, and she never would have had to spend the money on such a setting. Let me make a couple of personal points. First of all, if any of my former students are here from the Naval Academy, please feel free to doze off. I promise I won't say anything you probably haven't heard many times before. But let me say a couple of personal observations. One about our Marine colleagues. Look, in the Foreign Service, I think all of you know we serve very closely with the Marines, and the reason, and I have special affection for our Marine colleagues, for a very personal reason. The reason I am alive and here today to pontificate about Iran is because of some 20, 21, 22-year-old Marine security guards in Tehran in 1979, whose discipline and whose training and professionalism saved not only my life, but the life of about several hundred people that day at the embassy. And I cannot speak highly enough of how they performed that day. It wasn't easy. It was difficult. If somebody had lost control and started shooting, the simple fact is I wouldn't be here now. So that's a special, I always feel that special bond with Marines. I can't thank them enough. Second, when I speak about Iran, I must admit, I have not been there now for about 31 years. It's been part of my life in one way or another for about 45 years, but for the last, since 1981, I've not been there. Not by choice. I would love to go, but circumstances won't allow it. But even so, and that gap, I think, reflects through the U.S. government and the bureaucracy that deals with Iran. So as Dr. Tarzi mentioned, last year, in 2009, I went back, I came out of retirement, went and worked at the State Department on Iran for about nine or ten months. But when the interesting thing to me was when the State Department was looking for someone to deal with Iranian affairs, they didn't have anybody on active duty who had experienced it or had dealt with the country. So they had to figuratively go out and open. What did they do? They went out and they opened the gates of Jurassic Park, and they looked around, and over there they saw this beast, and they gr- grazing happily out in the corner, and they said, that looks like an Iranosaurus to me. And so I was brought back. I came back. No, I did not foresee the situation that we and the Iranians, the U.S. and Iran, is in today. About 30 years ago, almost exactly just over 30 years ago, I and my colleagues left Tehran, and I didn't believe that the estrangement would last as long as it did. I said 5 years, 7 years. We and the Iranians will be talking to each other. We may not be friends. We won't be friends probably for a long time, but at least we'll be able to talk to each other about issues of mutual concern. It hasn't happened. And I certainly didn't predict that for 30 years the relationship would consist of a state, what I call a state of futility, in which we and the Iranians glare at each other, thump our chests, trade insults, call each other names, and occasionally worse, escalates to violence and murder. Now, how have Iranian administrations seen American administrations seen Iran over this last 30 years? Well, it's interesting to go back. You go back to January of 1978, to New Year's Day, or New Year's Eve, actually, the day before. President Carter and Mrs. Carter were in Tehran. The Shah was on his throne, looking very secure, and President Carter called Iran an island of stability in a turbulent region. Well, we all know what happened. A year later, the Shah was gone, and Iran was in chaos. Subsequent administrations would have, I think, preferred to ignore Iran, just have it not be there, to go away. Things were difficult. You approached it. If you approached it, you got burned. But we couldn't ignore it. Here, I'll paraphrase a former resident of New York by the name of Leon Trotsky, who said, you may not have anything to do with war, but war has something to do with you. And I think the same applied with Iran. Administrations may not have wanted anything to do with Iran, but Iran had things to do with us. So if we couldn't ignore Iran, what did we try to do? Well, we tried to overthrow the government. We tried to change the government, to moderate its policies, to sell it weapons, to make peace with it, to make outreach with it, to contain it, all of these things. And the history is unfortunate, and it's littered with the wreckage of these various attempts. I mean, look, Iran destroyed the presidency of Jimmy Carter, the only president who's ever graduated from the institution where I teach, It almost destroyed the presidency of his successor. Came that close to bringing down President Reagan. Could I shift to the first slide, please? This picture, to me, illustrates the current state of Iranian relations. Or maybe the state of U.S.-Iranian relations over the last 30 years. Call it the road to nowhere. Because over 30 years, it seems that there are five principles that govern this relationship. And the five principles are these. Number one is never walk through an open door if you can bang your head against the wall. Much easier. Number two, never say yes to anything. Because if you do, you will look weak. Number three is anything the other side proposes. These are, by the way, these apply, I think these rules apply on both sides of the divide. So number three is anything the other side proposes must contain some kind of trick, because the other side's only purpose in life is to cheat us. That's what they do. And the corollary of that is rule number four, which is that the other side is infinitely hostile, devious, domineering, and irrational. And you cannot deal with, you cannot trust people like that. And rule number five, whatever you want is this, whatever you want to do, and whenever you seem to be making some progress, someone or some diabolical coincidence will come along and screw it up. Now, do you think I'm exaggerating? I don't think so. Look at recent history, and you have plenty of examples. Now, it was not always this way. I took as the title of my talk, Endless Enemies. We have not been endless enemies, and I don't think we are condemned to be. There is a deep reservoir of goodwill for Americans in Iran, America and Americans in Iran, based, first of all, on the fact that we are neither British nor Russian, which is definitely a cardinal sin. Iran, in the past 100 years, has been undergoing a struggle, essentially to assert its dignity, to create a system that is accountable, that treats its citizens with decency, that gives citizens a voice in how they are governed, that limits the power of an autocratic or despotic regime. And this struggle goes back to the early 20th century, if not farther. And the U.S. has often been on the right side of that struggle. Very often we have been with Iranians in their aspirations. And let's go back. I can have the next slide. This is a demonstration from 1906. These are people demonstrating in favor of a constitution which would limit the power of the ruler. Essentially what the rulers were doing in those days, were selling off Iran's resources, including its oil, at fire sale prices for ready cash. And you notice what jumps out at you is these early protesters demonstrating for a better system, of course, are almost entirely clerics. These are religious, these are from the religious classes. Because, of course, in 1906, that was the intelligentsia of the country. I strongly recommend to you reading a book by Erbond Abrahamian called Modern Iran. And his research said, according to his research, the literacy rate in Iran in those days was about 5%. And this was literate Iran in those days. And these are people who were saying it is wrong for the government to treat us this way and to sell off the national wealth. Next slide. Here is another part of that struggle. This is from the 1950s. This is during the oil act, the nationalization struggle over Iranian oil. And I think this banner here is very simple and very eloquent. It simply says, leave our country alone. That's all it says. Leave us alone. Leave us alone. Okay, next slide. Here is an early example of someone who, of a young American, this is who stood with those Iranians fighting for something better. This is the grave in located in Tabriz. This is the grave of Howard Baskerville, a young missionary teacher, teaching at a missionary school there, who joined the constitutional movement and was killed during the fighting there in 1909. His grave is still there, I believe. I believe a few years ago, then President Khatami went and paid honor to Mr. Baskerville. Here's another example. This is not 1910, 1911. This is Morgan Schuster and his team. Morgan Schuster was an American Treasury official, came to Iran at the request of the parliament, the constitutionalists, who knew that if they were going to exert control, they needed to exert control over the money. And Mr. Schuster, whom you see there in the middle with the mustache, was sent by President Taft and was the Treasurer General of Tehran, Treasurer General of Iran, the constitutional government. You can see him there with his team of Americans and Iranians also, working again to bring the financial system of Iran under some kind of legal and regularize and bring some accountability to this system. This, by the way, like a lot of things, did not end well. He got on the wrong side of the Russians. The Russians gave the Iranians 48 hours, an ultimatum. He had 48 hours to kick him out. They left, and the British sat back and did nothing. Okay, next slide, please. This is my particular favorite of sort of the American role, the American role. I think this picture is fascinating. This is a photo from something called Tabriz Memorial High School. You can read about it. The sign says that this is on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of Tabriz Memorial High School, and the date of this photo is 1924. And look at the people in this picture. Look at the mix. Remember, I mean, if the illiteracy rate in 1905 was 5%, it probably 1924, I doubt it, it was much higher. This was before the reforms of Reza Shah. So this was a missionary school. But look at the picture. Look who's in the picture. You have foreign missionaries, presumably Americans, don't know. You have the women there, presumably wives and also teachers. And then you have two members of the clergy on the side. And then you have Iranian teachers also. You see them with the hats and the ties. They were what in those days were called the word they used was fokuli, which is now, it's a sort of derogatory term, but there's nothing wrong with it. It's from the French. It just means false collar. People who wore false collar, westernized Iranians. But all of these people, I would guess that most of these people didn't agree on very much, these three groups, but they did agree on one thing, and that was the importance of education. That if Iran was going to change, if it was going to progress, it had to educate its young people. And whether you were a clergyman, or whether you were a missionary, or a missionary wife, or an Iranian Fokoli, you agreed on that, whatever other disagreements you had. I don't think you could have such a picture today. Such a picture today would just be impossible to put together. This is 1920, this is 1924. All right, the last one, here is, go forward about to 1946, 1947. This is the period of when Iran was struggling to literally for its existence. After World War II, you had a separatist movement in the northwest province of Azerbaijan. Many people say this was the beginning of the Cold War, started right after with this incident. And here is Mr. Pishambari, who was the president of this breakaway province, the leader of the separatists. And behind him, you have, of course, his great friend and patron. And the U.S. played by all standards, although the details, historians still argue over the details, a very positive role. And it was partially thanks to some skilled diplomacy, both by Iranians and others, and through American support, that Iran was able to maintain its territorial integrity and keep what was its richest and most important province. If this breakaway movement had succeeded, I would say Iran today probably would not exist. It was that close. Now, this is the reservoir of goodwill. We can get rid of the slides. Thank you. Unless you want to look at Stalin for the rest of the for the rest of the talk. Obviously, you know, recent history is not so it is not so positive. But this reservoir of goodwill exists. Recent history is much more difficult, and what it has done, unfortunately, is to create a load of grievances with which we and the Iranians batter each other. And I won't go through the list, it's a pretty dreary one. I mean, on one side you talk about the coup of 1953 that overthrew Prime Minister Mossadegh, we talk about the SOFA, the Status of Forces Agreement fiasco back in 1963 to 1964, you have the U.S.'s unequivocal support for the Shah, the support for Iraq during the 1980s. On the other side, you have the embassy hostage seizure, the subsequent acts of terrorism, assassinations, and you have the assassination of dissidents. Then, most recently, you have this outrageous incident of the detention of two young American three and now two young American hikers. So let's just go back to the first slide for a second. Thank you. So here we are. Here we are. We're stuck. We're stuck on a road to nowhere. And we and the Iranians are on opposite sides of an abyss. We glare at each other. We've been glaring at each other for 30 years. We've been thumping our chests. And when you thump your chest for 30 years, you can guess what the results are. You get a pretty sore chest. And that's about it. Now, starting in very early in his presidency, in 2009, President Obama has made a serious effort to get us off this road, to break the deadlock. The results, to be very, very frank, have not been positive, have not been good. Results have been very disappointing. The Iranians, for whatever reason, seem unable to respond. The president himself, with his Harvard Law School training, said that the Iranians seem unable to get to yes. And that's right out of the Harvard Law School negotiation workshop, if you're familiar with that. So why not? What's wrong here? That's a good question. I don't have an answer with certainty. There is, of course, the idea of traditional distrust, all of this layers of distrust that build up over 30 years. I think it was rule number two, it says never say yes to anything, because if you do, you'll look weak. Ahmadinejad had an interesting explanation. They asked him, why didn't you accept this, why did you renege on the reactor deal, the research reactor deal you had reached in Geneva? Your representative, Mr. Jaffe, and Ambassador Burns had reached in Geneva in October 2009. Why did you go back on that? And Ahmadinejad's answer was interesting. He said it was a good deal. It was a good deal for us, but they talked about it in a way that hurt our pride. So we couldn't accept it. Very interesting. There are other explanations, but I think one thing you can say is that the president's approach of offering a dialogue without preconditions, based on mutual respect, has thrown the Iranians off balance. It's thrown them off their game. It's put them on the defensive. They don't know how to respond because they're dealing with something difficult here. They're dealing with someone who sends them greetings on their New Year's, who talks about mutual respect, who quotes Persian poetry, to them, and their old rhetoric, the old brave slogans, don't work anymore. They're just not believable. So they're left in a kind of limbo where they don't know how to respond. I mean, it's this, and they fall back on, well, we know it's a trick, we're not sure what it is, but we know it's a trick. It's got to be a trick. Just like when Secretary Clinton, a few months ago, was asked about the Bushehr nuclear reactor, and she said, well, we don't have any problem with the Bushehr nuclear reactor. There are safeguards, it's for peaceful purposes, we know that. And the Iranian reaction is, there's got to be a trick. She can't mean it. And that's the kind of thing that they fall back on. I think what happened, the other thing that happened, I think people may have underestimated just how hard it was going to be to get off this road. Because there are so many ghosts of history, the ghost of Mossadegh, the ghost of Kim Roosevelt, ghost of the sofa agreement, the ghost of Khomeini himself, they haunt this relationship. And people perhaps also underestimated how these five rules that I talked about, how they would keep their stranglehold. And they have. They're difficult. Danger now is that since the original attempt to establish dialogue, they hasn't borne fruit, hasn't gotten anywhere. I think it was Secretary Gates a few years back who said, we've been looking for Iranian moderates for 25 years and haven't found them yet. We're not getting anywhere. We still seem to be on this road. The danger is that both sides are going to say, you see, you fall back into the dysfunctional patterns of the past, doing what they've always done. Look, many of us work in the same bureaucracy. I did for 30, 33, 34 years. And careers in Washington, and I think careers in Tehran, I would guess careers in Tehran, were built on how creative you could be on bashing the other side. You know, what new insult could you think of? What new humiliation could you think of? What new sanction could you think of? I once asked my friend, why don't we try to get, why haven't we tried to get Iran under the anti-cannibalism convention? There must be something out there that we can do. And that's hard to break. People do what they know how to do. And this is what we know how to do, and this is what we're pretty good at. And somehow we're going to have to break the hold of these rules. How do we do it? Well, that's the toughest one. I don't have a magic formula. Short of the Iranians waking up one morning and saying, gosh, those last 30 years, forget about it. Now, let's try something else. I don't think that's gonna happen. But I would counsel what I think is very familiar to you. The standard tools of interaction, whether with a country or with a person, and those of course are patience, forbearance, and listening. Patience, a lot of it. This is not going to be easy. We're not going to succeed the first time. We're not going to succeed with one meeting. I recall what the Algerian intermediaries once said to President Carter as they were trying to negotiate. They were negotiating our freedom out of Tehran. They came to Washington in October or November of 1980. Went to see him in Camp David. Negotiations were very difficult. They were not making progress. And he asked them, what advice do you have for me? And he said, don't give up. Keep at it. So a lot of patience. I would also advise listening. It's amazing what you could do, what you can learn when you listen. Not that we agree with what we hear, not that we like what we hear, but at least we can make an attempt to understand what we hear. Let me give you an example. Back in September, after I left the State Department, I was a private citizen. Out of the blue, I got an invitation to go to New York and to attend a dinner discussion with President Ahmadinejad for American academics. And this is something he had done. He had actually been doing this for the last previous 3-4 years, ever since he was coming to New York. And I must say, to give the devil his due, he is, as far as I know, the only head of state to do this during the General Assembly. Of course, he can't go out on a speaking tour outside of New York. He went to Columbia, that didn't work very well. That didn't go very well, but he can't go, he can't take the round. He couldn't come here or go to universities because he's under travel restrictions. But, so I went to this, and in the discussion, one of the questions that came up was, is Iran seeking a nuclear weapon? Right. And I thought his answer was interesting. Not whether I believe him or not, not whether I agree with him or not, but just interesting from what he said. He said this. He said, no, we're not. We are opposed to nuclear weapons on ideological grounds. They are weapons of murder. They serve no political purpose for us. They are not in our interest. They are expensive. They are dangerous, and so forth and so on. And you can believe that or not believe that. But then he said this. He said, but the decision to build or not build a nuclear weapon must be our decision. It is a decision for Iranians to make, not the IAEA, not the Security Council, not the United States, not the P5, not the P5+1, nobody else. We will make that decision. Now that's interesting. I found that very interesting. Anybody who's ever raised an adolescent, I think, will find it very familiar. In other words, I will do the right thing, but it is my decision. It is my decision to do the right thing. Anyway, so what's to be done? One piece of advice that I like, I recall something that President Obama said, I think 6 days after his inauguration, when he spoke to Al Arabiya television about. He was talking not about Iran so much, about the Middle East in general and Arab-Israel issues. He said we have to put aside negative preconceptions. That is the assumption. If you go into an encounter with the other side, with Iran, assuming already that they are simply too stubborn, too irrational, too unreasonable, all of these things, then we are going to fail. This becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Second, one way or another, both of us are going to have to deal with the ghosts in the room. Could be the ghosts of the 79 hostage crisis, the ghosts of the 53 coup, the ghosts of the Airbus shoot down, even the ghosts going all the way back to the Treaty of Turkmenchai in 1827, whatever they are, because the ghosts are there, and they don't just come out at Halloween. They're in the room, and if you ignore them, they will haunt you. Very often someone asked me, what do we need in our Iran policy? I said, we need the Ghostbusters. You remember Bill Murray and was it Dan Aykroyd? They had this wonderful machine, kind of like a vacuum cleaner, that they picked up the ghosts and they put it away. Well, we need something like that. Finally, while we need high expectations, we also need patience and realistic expectations. And I'll just end by recalling. Which says that whatever you do, remember, whatever you do will be harder than you think, whatever you do will take longer than you think, and somewhere somebody's going to come along and screw it up. And that is going to happen, and keep that in mind as all of you deal with this very difficult issue. Well, I thank you very much for your attention. I'd be very happy. We have some time for questions, and I would be happy to deal with it. Thank you.
Ambassador Lemberg has chosen to take charge of the floor himself. I want to make one announcement before we start that. The sixth lecture of the series will be on the 17th March. On our regular time, which is 1400, we accommodate for the ambassador to Turkey. And it will be Mr. Afshin Molavi. The title is Iran and the Persian Gulf States Between Commerce and Confrontation. Those of you who are on the list, Adam has been kind and he has received it. Those of you who are not and you want to be put on our list, please see Adam, and they're also recommend. Please pick them. I'm going to forego my chair, because I think there will be other people questioning if there's time. I'll go ahead, but you can go ahead, please.
Okay. Let me just put a plug in for Afshin Molad. He's excellent, if you haven't heard him speak, and also he has a number of books that you might want to look at. So I think there was a question right there. Yes, sir.
Sir, I have a question. Thank you for your talk. Gene McKenzie's work, Reset, advocates federal relations with Iran. And he suggests that it's not ghosts in the relationship, but it's Israel. And the American relationship, strategic partnership with Israel, almost a sliding scale, that we'll never have relations with Iran as long as we have a relationship with Israel. And reciprocally, they're happy to become close to Iran, we've got to distance ourselves from Israel. Comments on that?
You know, in a way, that's almost, unfortunately, condemning us to stay on this road. I don't see it that way, honestly. I don't think it's such an all or none. I mean, there have been, it's clearly a complicating fact. But at various times, the Iranians have made statements like, look, whatever agreement the Arabs and Israelis come to, whatever agreement the Palestinians and the Israelis come to, that's okay with us. We are not going to interfere with those things. I mean, if we and the Iranians sit down and we talk about Israel, we're going to fail. We're not going to get anywhere. My view and others, the view of others, and I reflect somebody I don't admire. I'm not an admirer of Henry Kissinger for obvious reasons, but one thing he said recently I thought was pretty good, where he said, we have more common interests with Iran than we do with a lot of our friends. And many of those interests, such as Afghanistan, such as Iran, such as narcotics, such as terrorism, many of those issues have nothing to do with Israel. Israel is what I call the big gate. The big gate. What I think in Persian you call it the Ali Khakun. The high gate, and it's closed. It's pretty much locked up and closed. So what maybe you need to do is to pursue what our Hungarian friends have a nice, they call the Kiskapu, the little gate. Look for the loophole, the little gate. How do you get around that? But you know, Israel's a bit like, for me, it's a bit like the nuclear. It's a bit like a nuclear issue. You know, if you go right at it, you try to go right at it to resolve, you're going to fail because there's too much other things attached. I like Kinzer. I admire what he says. His book, All the Shah's Men, I think is very.
He makes the same point. That we share so much in common with the Iranian people.
Not just the people. But believe it or not, the government, you know, as distasteful as it is, I think Hillary Clinton called it awful, as awful as it is, we still share, we have things to talk, about, which we seem unable to do. Yes, sir. Tom.
Well, thank you, John, very much for your insights. I will confess my admiration for you the following way. When I was head of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, we started a Persian service, and John was the first person I asked to be the head of our Persian service, and he bluntly said no. So thanks very much, John.
Might have been a mistake.
Your career is admirable. So much of your talk today has followed on so many ideas and so many experiences I've had. In the last 2.5 years, I've been running a track 2 with Syria. And I could almost not all, but I could almost replace Syria with Iran throughout that. And I keep looking at that road, and I keep holding my head.
Yeah.
It hurts after a while after you bump up against that wall. Having said that, A, could you comment on what, and I believe with you, you must create personal trust before you go anywhere. And I've tried that over and over and over again. And I have. But when they go, the prominent Syrians I've been dealing with, they go to the dictator, and then he finds ways of not doing it because the security services or whatever are saying no, the Baathist party is saying no. So how do you, instead of bumping your head and cracking your skull, what can you do? A, B, could you comment on the Iranian-Syrian relationship?
First of all, when Tom was at Radio Free Europe and he set up something called Radio Azadi, Radio Freedom, it was superb. It was probably the best thing going out there in the Persian language, bringing news. It also, and it was about the same time that President Khatami came into office, so there was a kind of a fortune. We don't with Iran very much, but that was what. The other issue about track two, who do these things. But the question remains, why, in the case of Iran, and Iran, I still say we are miles behind Syria. In Syria, at least we have an embassy there. At least we have ways of talking to each other. With Iran, we do not. But as talking about the track two, it should work. We've been doing it with the Iranians now for about 15 years, if not longer. And wrestling teams have gone, mountaineering teams have gone, scholars have gone, journalists have gone, artists have gone, medical people,
movie
filmmakers have gone. I mean, look, the ping pong players went to China, and a year later, I think, roughly a year later, Nixon was there talking to Chairman Mao. In the case of Iran, it hasn't happened. And so all of these things, for some reason, they haven't led to where they should have led. It isn't that they're not worth doing, because they very much are. How do you break it? How do you break it? Let me give, if you'll indulge me for 3 minutes, I'll tell you one approach that I think is very interesting. Are any of you familiar with something called the Jackson, Mississippi Medical Project? Are you familiar with this? This is very interesting. This is a project down in the Mississippi Delta. Those of you know, the Mississippi Delta area, northeastern Mississippi, is a part of our country that has traditionally been at the bottom in every measure of social and economic development. Last in education, highest in unemployment, high in drug use, high in criminality, all the problems that are all in this one area. And they've defied attempts to help. I mean, money has gone in, projects have gone in, and nothing seems to work. A few years ago, a group of people in Mississippi heard about a project in Iran called the Behvaz, the Rural Health Houses. And this was a means of delivering primary health care in underserved rural areas. And the more they looked at it, the more interested they became. And they said, we could learn something from this project. So they contacted the University of Shiraz, which was the executing party in Iran, and said, here's what we're interested in. The University of Shiraz contacted the Ministry of Health in Tehran. And guess what the answer was? Of course. Of course, we're happy to help. Come on over. And groups from Mississippi have been going to Iran, groups from Iran have been coming here, and all, there have been stories about it. There was a report, I think, on NBC that congressman from Mississippi has gotten interested and is supporting this. And with all the noise and all the denunciations that are going on here, this particular project is working. Now, why is it working? My theory is because we are the asker. We are not demanding anything. We are not giving advice. We are not offering advice. We have given ourselves what I call the advantage of the lower hand. We are coming in and we are asking. And one of the Mississippi people on the project told me the story. He said we were in a small village near Shiraz. We were stopped in a tea house. We were stopped in a tea house to rest. And one of the local, we were speaking English with our Iranian counterparts, and one of the local people there asked, in a not very nice tone, said, "What are these Americans doing here? I thought we got rid of them." And the answer was, "They're here because they need our help." And the response was, "Well, that's different. That we can do." Now, so that to me, that is a promising way to go. Put ourselves in that kind of the problem. I could not figure out. I couldn't do this when I was back in State Department. I was trying my best to say, okay, how do we take something like this and move it into the political field? You know, and get people up, you know, high up the chain to take this model and work it. And I'm still not there yet. But if any of you have ideas, the Syrian relation is nowhere. I mean, you know, it's a hostile relationship. But it's not a friendly one. But at least we're able to talk to her. I would say if the hikers had gone the other direction from Iraq, hadn't gone toward Iran, but had gone toward Iraq, they would have been out in six weeks. But because we don't talk to each other, any small incident like that gets much worse than it should be. In the far back.
Sir, how much of the religious rhetoric do you think is an example of what is truth? And how much is just kind of bluster and to be done to make a point? You know, the whole place Satan talking, this kind of things of that nature.
Well, I'm the last one who should say, well, that's just rhetoric. Because that's what we said on November 3rd, 1979. And then we found that rhetoric, you know, the anti-American rhetoric actually had some teeth in it. People did things. When you say the religious rhetoric, could you be a little more specific?
Religious language that's used to demonize the United States, how much of that do you feel is genuine? And how much of it is done, just so I kind of put it up front.
Okay. If you haven't seen it, I recommend to you on that issue, I recommend a film called Pilgrimage to Karbala. It follows a group of Iranian pilgrims going to Karbala in 2006. 2006. And of course, the reason that they could make the pilgrimage was thanks to us and our military and our military colleagues who overthrew Saddam Hussein and opened the road for them to go to Karbala. But don't expect any thanks for it. But there is a lot of religious imagery now that gets transferred into political term. So you hear things like Bush is in this. If you watch this film, you'll hear things like Bush is Yazid, and Blair is Yazid, meaning and Yazid is the arch villain of Shia Islam, who was responsible for killing in the third Imam Hussein at Karbala. For most Iranians that I know and talk to, the religious impulse is very genuine. That is, when people weep for Hussein, mourn Hussein, or know the death of Hussein, that is very genuine. The political transference is something that the government does. Some people will accept it. Some people will accept it. Most people will mouth it because they have to. Because their survival, their well-being, their position, everything else depends on it. But it is a stretch. But it uses imagery, obviously. When you talk about Hussein, for example, and Yazid, and we Iranians are Hussein and we're the victims, and these terrible Blair and Bush and everybody else, these outsiders, they're the Yazidis, that resonates to a point. But again, much of that is you can see that the government is using it. How long that will be effective, how long they use it, I don't think so. I don't think so. Question over here.
Sir Colin Gray, in a book on future warfare, aren't used for the continued existence of nuclear weapons because they are so strategically useful. So despite, I guess, President Ahmadinejad's comments that they don't find them useful, it seems like an Iranian nuclear weapon would be incredibly useful. Do you think the Iranians are trying to develop a nuclear weapon?
I don't know. They say they're not. I wish I could believe them. I defer. There are others who are much more informed about this. The consensus seems to be that if they're not developing nuclear weapons, they're not being very honest about what they are doing. And what they may be doing is developing what I guess is called a breakout capacity, or a virtual nuclear weapon, where they have the ability to build a bomb in a short period of time. I mean, what does it do for them? The argument I make to my Iranian friends is, you want a nuclear weapon? Fine. That will make you just like Pakistan. And they don't like that. They do not like being compared to Pakistan. What is it going to do? But there is, there is issues of emotion, there are issues of respect, of perceived respect, place in the world, and so forth and so on. I have no doubt, and I wish I didn't believe this, but I do, that the day after the Iranians exploded a nuclear weapon or announced that they have a nuclear weapon, that people in the streets will be celebrating because of the symbolism. But the strategic issues, I'm just not good at knowledgeable enough. Yes, sir.
Sir, Mason Clark from Penn State College, student there. My question about all the discussion about dialogue with Iran, who are we supposed to talk to? They don't run like a typical country does, the way we envision, Ahmadinejad and powers like our president has. He doesn't really call the shots there. The Supreme Leader supposedly does, but increasingly, they're dependent on the IRGC to hold power. There's a lot of discussion with analysts about the IRGC actually calling the shots in the direction of the country. So, with all the discussion on dialogue, who do we talk to?
Yeah. Good question. No, you can end up in, as we saw, I mentioned how the Iran-Contra almost brought down President Reagan because we ended up talking to the wrong people, or people who misled us and who pretended to be things that they were not, to represent things they were not, and can get one into serious trouble. On the other hand, I've always said, look, I take a page out of my State Department training. At one point in State Department training, we were having a discussion about dealing with the U.S. military. Talk about cultural differences. And one of the things they said to us, and this was great advice, they said, the worst thing you can do, never, ever second guess the U.S. military's chain of command. You'll always get it wrong. Find a POLAD, political advisor, a POLAD, or a point of contact who works, who you can work with and use that, and let that person work the chain of command, because you will never understand it. And in the case of Ron Big, it's the same thing. We cannot game their system, to say, okay, Ahmadinejad is not very, is this, or foreign minister is that, or the Revolutionary Guards are something else. What matters for us is who can deliver, and what that person's title is, what faction he's in, is to me is irrelevant. Can that person deliver? Secretary Christopher, or Deputy Secretary, 1980, when he started the negotiation process, got us out of Tehran, went to his Iranian counterpart, who was somebody he didn't know, had been recommended by the German embassy, recommended by the German embassy, and was a relation of Khomeini by marriage, and as they talked, he asked straight out. He said, "How do I know you can deliver what you say you can? What you say you can?" And he said, "Watch. Khomeini is going to make a speech this next Friday. In this speech, he is going to say the following four things: A, B, C, D. And the next Friday, Khomeini made this long, rambling speech about domestic affairs, and at the end of it, he said these four things." So we knew, Christopher knew at that point, he was dealing with somebody serious. You're going to run into some false alarms, but you're right that whoever it is has to be serious. But we can't gain the system. We are concerned. And if someone approaches you and says, I speak on behalf of somebody or somebody else, it's pretty easy to test whether they can do it. Yes, sir, in the far back.
Lieutenant Whalen, basic school. Question about
you weren't my student, were you?
Yes, sir. The situation about Bahrain and rest there, how will that affect our opening up negotiations? Does that have the potential to unravel anything you've tried to do, or does that, how might that play out in the future?
Well, I leave it for others to talk about Bahrain and what's going on there. But obviously, whatever happens makes it more complicated, but it shouldn't affect it directly. I mean, as I said, there are issues between us and the Iranians that are between us and the Iranians. And Bahrain can be in turmoil, Libya can be in turmoil, Tunisia can be in turmoil. That's of its own way. The only thing that's interesting is that Iran it's been interesting to watch the statements coming out of Tehran about the various waves of protest in the Arab world. I mean, they'll say things like, yes, the people of Egypt and Libya and Bahrain, they deserve to have free elections. They deserve freedom of speech. They deserve freedom of expression. They should have the right to march, to march peacefully. As someone said, Egypt gets democracy, Iran gets hypocrisy. Because obviously these things could have, could, and I think will definitely have reverberation in Tehran. The saying going around Iran after the events in Tunisia was Tunis, Tunis, Iran, na Tunis. Means Tunis could, Iran couldn't. And what makes it particularly difficult, is that Iran, historically looked down on its Arab neighbors and said, we had the great civilization, we are people of 2,500 years of history, we have this, we have that, but yet these people who we look down on are doing things we would like to do but cannot do. So in that way it reverberates. A direct effect on relations, since the relations don't exist, it's almost an academic, it's a good hypothetical question. But I don't see it. Yeah, questions?
Yeah, we read in the newspaper, Max Grossman, retired from the National Defense Intelligence College. We read in the newspaper the other day that we opened up a logistics supply line in Afghanistan from Russia. And part of that is to counterbalance our reliance on the logistics line from Pakistan. Another possibility, maybe you know something about this, the way through the last years in the State Department would be a logistic line through Iran, which would make the balance even better. Have we pursued this? Something we could talk to Iran about? Something would be in our interest?
No, it should be a no-brainer. It should be something that we are talking to the Iranians about. Ambassador Holbrooke, when he was alive, was very much interested in pursuing these kinds of ideas. Maybe not that, not only that, but other ways. Because what he said was, like it or not, Iran has a great deal of influence over what happens farther east, to its east. And so, we should take that into consideration. We should take that into consideration, and our policies of stiffing the Iranians on all things in view of our goals in Afghanistan, doesn't make sense. He would argue very strongly for that. I can't say I know something, and I'm not telling you anything. I just don't know. To the best of my knowledge, there were no particular substantive discussions of that subject.
I certainly never heard of it.
And I think, it goes back, some of it goes back to those rules. There's just a reluctance. There's just a reluctance to move forward. It's difficult. It's new. It's complicated. Much easier just to bashing them, because that's what we know how to do. But it's a good question. It's a good question. Yes, sir.
I'm from Dan Bernard. I'm thanking you for your remarks. You said that you probably you must be the same as before, but I have heard you several times, and every one of you has been more insightful. So I thank you for the remark today. My question, I want to take it back to the goals and particular surrounding Iran-US relationship. And the very interesting point that you made, that Iran's acting government, the activist and example of Ahmadinejad. On that, I want to get your view about, since we know how Iranians are acting, and if we are the adult side, or the adult person, or is the child, how come we are not taking that into our considerations of their concerns and their quote-unquote insecurities, if you will, that they have, and the reality of, you know, they have this history and the pride and everything else. When we deal with them, why we just do not understand them? When we talk about incentives, why do we have to add sticks to the carrots? And whenever we President Obama talks about this, opening the fist, but then, you know, if you don't do this, we do that. So there's always an if coming afterwards. My question is that, you know, why we just don't get rid of it? That's one question. The other question is that maybe it's also relevant, is that what do you think of, I mean, since all these factors that you mentioned really dominates the relationship, why the Americans, at least this has been suggested by the Leverets, they just don't take the bold step and what President Nixon did to China. Go do something dramatically different and perhaps, you know, overcome all the bureaucrats and all the concerns that exist in both sides. Perhaps that way the relationship can go to another phase.
Let me answer your last question first, as I understand it, which is with, why not make a bold step? You mentioned Nixon going to China. That was done with a lot of preparation, actually. I mean, there was a lot of preparation involved in that. That wasn't just a spur-of-the-moment thing. Maybe another metaphor might be Sadat to Jerusalem. Maybe that's what it would take. I mean, maybe that is sometimes, I mean, in our discussions, you know, when I, discussions among ourselves and talk to others, many people say it would take something that bold and that daring to get us off the road, The other thing you mentioned is very interesting. I mean, it's a whole subject of language and words, and you know, in our business, words matter. Words matter, symbols matter. And things like, you know, again, things like phrases like carrots and sticks, I agree with you, that's very insulting. Maybe it isn't meant that way, but it is. My particular hobby horse on this, or the phrase that really makes me cringe when people use it about Iran, is, well, they must change their behavior. Have you ever been in a relationship with somebody? Try that. Well, everything would be fine if you just changed your behavior. Guaranteed failure, I can believe. But believe it or not, I was told I felt like, you know, Don Quixote with a rubber lance on this one, because people would use it, people whom I respected would use it, and I'd call them out on it. I'd say, well, that's not going to accomplish anything. And they'd say, look, under the previous administration, change their behavior was the phrase used by moderates like me. You know, and the others was change the regime. We got to overthrow the regime. I mean, in those days, a moderate, I used to say that a moderate was somebody who said we should bomb them tomorrow. That was the moderate. But you're right. Words symbols, ghosts. Let's get back to the point about the ghosts. The ghosts are there in the room. And when you use unfortunate phrases, or it calls up all kinds of images, and how would you say, it brings out the ghosts, and we don't even know about them until they come back together. But this is very hard stuff, and it's very subtle stuff. And one reason it's so difficult, and it gets back to your question, Tom, about Syria, is that since we and the Iranians, at least officially, are barely talking to each other, the opportunity for these kinds of clashes become much worse. Like Ahmadinejad's rhetoric about the Holocaust, or talking what he said about 9/11. I'm sure, my own feeling is when he said that at the UN, there were probably a lot of other people in that audience who may have believed it, but at least they had the diplomatic sense and experience not to say it in public at the General Assembly of the United Nations, which he did. Look, what happens when two countries or two parties don't talk to each other for a long time? I think this is how what happens is both sides build an image of the other. And that image is simultaneously superhuman and subhuman. That is, you see the other as powerful, threatening, devious, hostile. That's the superhuman. On the other hand, you see them as pernicious, as evil, as mendacious, all of these things. And so when that happens, when you're not, and your only contact is through third parties or through distorted, or through statements of people, and when you see someone as superhuman, what do? You fear them. You fear them. And you say, that person is a threat. That person threatens me. When you see them as subhuman, you despise them. And it's very easy to say, well, we'll just eliminate them. That's all. Because that's all they understand. So you put your finger on some very, very tough issues and some very basic ones. Okay. Any other question? Mr. Tazi, did you? I know you wanted to say something.
Well, I actually go back to my past life, which is nuclear. Utility of nuclear weapons. Just at lunch, we were discussing the issue of utility of it. I cannot but think of Colonel Gaddafi. Prior to giving up his rather robust nuclear capability, he was not even sort of invited to talk to people, no foreign, European or American contact, at least officially, was made with him. Suddenly he tried to, he said he's not even making this nuclear program, and he gave it up, and literally overnight he was hailed in Brussels as a hero, and British Airways started flying to Tripoli, and then of course those opportunities came up to oil deals and all that. All I'm saying is that even by trying and then giving up a nuclear potential, Libya from a pariah became an ally, or a semi-ally. At least in the European countries, a lot of them opened up their doors. We were not as jumpy, but we did also. So he had not changed. Worst of it, we were discussing Libya got a seat in human rights.
Right.
A majority of the world actually voted for that.
Right.
So the question is,
I'm still questioning whether or not nuclear weapons or the Chernobyl, you said something which I agree with, could be even playing the game. Yes, there's a, you talk about Pakistan, but there's also another effect. The fact that North Korea is combatant, you take the nukes, it's a starving country. You take the nukes out of, nuclear option out of Libya, Libya would have been a pariah state up to today. And I think for Iran, don't you agree, and this is the question is, that right now the fact that it matters as much is the fact whether they have it or not, they may be exaggerating it, but it's the card that makes them relevant more than what they are. That's the question.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think you're right. Here's the problem. If all we can talk about with the Iranians is the nuclear issue, we're going to fail. We're going to stay on that road. And the reason is because what happens is we end up, you folks like to talk about asymmetric warfare. But when we and the Iranians talk about nuclear things, we have asymmetric negotiations where one side is talking about LEU and HEU and Article 3.1 and additional protocol and enrichment and centrifuges and subterfuges and all these things. The other side is talking about something quite different. They're talking about their place in the world and how they relate to the rest of the world and national, what are their national rights and what are they entitled to and who makes, going back to President Ahmadinejad, that's why I found it so interesting. He's talking about our decision. This is our decision to make. So you have one side of here, the other side here, and both sides are talking past each other, and each side, and I can't tell you the number of times I've heard this, says, they're not listening to us. We're saying something and they're not listening to us. We're calling them on the telephone and they don't, and they're telling, and nobody's picking up on the other line. But what you said, it's part of this effort to, if you like, to assert oneself and say,
to take a seat in the table.
That's right. Because no country enjoys being an international polecat. Nobody likes that. But Iran, particularly, I sense it that this. The isolation, the being singled out, the sanctions, all of these things, the people won't deal with them, people won't talk to them, people won't visit them. That bothers them probably more than most because it goes against their sense of self and their sense of what their position in the world should be. So
thank you.
That I take your point. I think it's a very good one. Okay, one last. We have time for one last question.
Please, go ahead.
Sir.
So just leading to the question the gentleman asked, will not call it carrot and sticks.
Call it.
Will not call it carrot and
sticks. Carrot sticks. Okay, thank you.
But don't you think that whenever any negotiation is carried out, on one hand you say, okay, we are ready to talk, but you sign NPT, but you sign CTPT. Something which is not a carrot and stick, but a precondition for solving the issues. Just leading to that, a very small example. You just said that if Iran gets a nuclear bomb, the situation would be like Pakistan, you said. It would be like India. Why did you compare it to India? Why is
that
so?
Okay, no, good point. I was making a rhetorical point about Pakistan. Because if I said about India, it wouldn't have the same, would not have the same resonance, negative resonance for Iranians.
By the way, I'm from India.
You're right. I figured. No, if I say it will make you like India, it's wonderful.
But if they say things like Pakistan, then there are real problems. They understand the commentary. It's rhetorical.
No, look, you know, sometimes in negotiation, you sometimes have to face the fact that there's no, may not be room for agreement at this point, but you're just not going to get off that. You're not going to get off the road, at least for now. And sometimes you do need to recognize that. The problem, of course, always is how does one make the point that some agreement is better than the situation you have now? And that can be by saying, okay, if you make an agreement, good things will happen and bad things will not happen. Now you can call that pressure, you can call that carrot, you can call that stick, but I recall what an Iranian friend of mine once said to me. He was a political scientist. He said, we Iranians, we never give in to pressure. We only give in to a lot of pressure. So, and the question then, I mean, the next question is, what is a lot of pressure? You know, what's a lot of pressure? What are you willing to do? But clearly, you know, it's call them incentives, call them something else. But images like carrot and stick will not get you off this road. That's true. And sometimes, you know, as I said, sometimes language in this case matters. Okay, well, thank you all very much.